The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 30th of June, 2020. I'm here in Salisbury with Jeff Harding in his home. Jeff, thank you very much for agreeing to talk with me and to be a part of this program, the RSL, A Time to Celebrate. Could I ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and your service number, please?
Jeffrey Lance Harding, 16853, and service number being the senior service, R108712.
Jeff, could I ask you, just to get things started today, could you just share a little bit of information about where you're from, maybe a little bit about your childhood and family life?
Yep. Yeah, I was born in Largs Bay Hospital, but that's gone now. And we lived in Port Adelaide for a little while down in Exeter. And then my parents, Dad got a house up in Seacombe Gardens, brand new. He was the butcher. He was the local butcher up there and everyone knew him. And I went to Darlington Primary School and then moved on to Seacombe High. I went up to third year and left school because schooling wasn't really me. And I'd put in to join the Navy, and I had a couple of odd jobs when I left school, and then I joined the Navy in August 1970. I liked recruit training. Remember when the bus first pulled up? And we got there, probably would have been about up at 6, 7 at night, and everyone's yelling out the windows, "You'll be sorry." And then we've unpiled from the bus, put all our gear in a room, and then we had to go across to the cafeteria for meals. And we're sitting on this long bench set up, and we're having our meals, and then must have been the Kallik chef, he comes out. Great big huge bloke he was, and he come out with this meat cleaver and he went bang right on the table, and of course everyone jumped, and he said, "Any complaints about the food?" Everyone's, "Oh no, ooh, loved it." And that was my first night at recruit training, but I enjoyed it. I got on pretty well with all the instructors, so I was like instructor's pet, I suppose, then. So everything went pretty smooth for me.
Could you give me like a typical day during your recruit training? What was a typical day?
It was all learned to start off with. It was all learning discipline and marching, and it was just trying to break you down so they could build you up in the way the Navy likes it. A lot of punishments, if things didn't go right, you had to go out at night, run around with a weapon above your head. Keep out and stand in the cold for long periods. Had all little different punishments for different crimes that you got away with. If one got done, you all got done. And
they were good times, were they, the recruit training? Good memories?
Well, I haven't got that many memories left now. The old brain matter's not as good as it used to be. But, I enjoyed my time there. You see all these, like, American ones where they're all yelling and screaming. It sort of didn't happen in there. A lot of yelling and screaming, but it sort of wore off a duck's back to me. You know, names never hurt me.
So recruit training, have you any more experiences that you'd like to talk about with recruit training?
Or? Well, not so much recruit training. On completion of recruit training, I went to my first ship. I served on 6 warships and 6 submarines during my time. And my first one was the destroyer escort, HMAS Swan. And I always remember that was my first time we come into rough seas. It was really rough, and it was middle of the night. And when the ship goes down, sometimes it tends to hang a bit. And it's a horrible feeling. Everybody's out of the bunk at the same time because the ship's hanging too long in one, because a lot of ships can sink through that way. And then the ship shudders and then it starts coming up and everyone sort of turns around, smiles to each other and climbs straight back into bed like it was nothing. Yeah. And that was my first experience at rough seas, that one. Then my next ship I got onto, that was the fast troop ship, ex-aircraft carrier HMAS Sydney. And that was a good, happy ship, that one. We went to Vietnam on there, and also we went up the west coast of America and Canada. We got a really good jolly in, and I was only 16 and a half, and sort of in them days going interstate was a big thing, let alone going all the way around the world sort of thing.
How did that feel, being at such a young age and suddenly you're on the other side of the planet, side of the globe? Yeah,
it didn't. It was good because you had your mates with you there. And the only bad part about it is I had Cinderella leave because I was under 16 and a half. No, under 17 and a half, you had to be back on board by midnight. And so we used to always tell everybody I had to go back and read signals and, you know, some exciting job I had to go back on board for. And but that was a really good trip, that one. It took months, that one, a couple of months, and we had a sort of a long stay because we were, you know, first warship that's been around these areas in a long time, especially Australian. And we tied up in one port there next to these American aircraft carriers, and top of our mast didn't even reach their flight decks. And their pilots used to look down and, God damn, you blokes fly off on that, you know. remember we're out of Hawaii, we're about one night out, and we hit a tidal wave. No warning, no nothing. It was in the middle of the night. I'd just come off watch, so it would have been around midnight. And this is not long after the Frankie Evans collision with the Melbourne, and the Melbourne lost its bow and cut the Frankie Evans in half. And that was the first thing that went through my head because it was all dark in the mess, and next minute we were sleeping in hammocks, and next minute there was a mighty bang and everything went flying forward. The whole ship shook, and we lived in the deck below the hanging space there, so we was pretty high up out of the water, and ship never had air conditioning. Used to have portholes and you put wind scoops out, you know, push the air inside the messes. And there was a mighty bang, the ship shuddered, and next minute water come gushing in from everywhere through the portholes. And I thought, oh Christ, we hit another ship, and I'm in the part that's going underwater because of the amount of water that come in. And later on we found out we hit a tidal wave and no one saw it coming.
Which way did it hit the ship?
Oh, front on. We have to hit it front on because we all went flying that way forward. And the whole ship shuddered and water comes gushing in everywhere. Yeah, it was pretty good. And all the ports we went to, San Diego, San Francisco, the Yanks put all big parties on for us. Oh, that was good. Free grog. And nothing better a sailor likes than free grog. And Canada, that was really good. We was one of the first Australian warships to be up there since the war. And they put a really good do on for us up there. I got offered work. They said, oh, leave the Navy and come and work for us. And because they thought I was in my 20s. And, you know. Remember one woman there in Esquimalt in Canada, she ran this bar that we were drinking at. And the drinking age was 19 in America, in Canada. And we're all talking to her and she goes, oh, you know what I pride myself on? We said, what's that? Picking out underage drinkers. And I said, oh yeah, pretty easy, isn't it? Yeah.
So you got away with that one?
Oh yeah, we were drinking there and all the time. And remember when we first went into this pub and they'd fill your drink up and you have about that much head. You have about, you know, 3 inches of head on your beer. And we thought that he was going to go away and come back and top them up for us. And we're waiting and waiting, and the bloke started doing nothing. So we called him out and we said, "Oi, aren't you going to fill our beers up?" And he goes, "They are full." We said, "Rubbish. Look at the ad on them." And he goes, "Oh, where are you guys from?" We said, "Australia." He goes, "Oh, I've been there. Here, here, let me fill it up to the top for you." So the three of us, we're the only ones that had beers filled right at the top. Everyone else was whinging around the place. But there was a little marker on the glass, and he showed us, but we got away with more beer. Then next, I went, I got a posting to the River Class frigate, HMAS Diamantina. That's where I met Jackie over there. The ship was based in Western Australia. It's called the Grey Ghost of the West Coast. And it was pretty well an oceanographic survey vessel. And we spent a lot of time up in Christmas Island. And once there, Jackie, she was going to ring me up at Christmas Island. And she had to wait 3 days sitting in the post office so they could connect through to the ship. We'd tie up sometimes at this wharf, and it's where big container ships tie up. And the phone line come down off a crane and come all the way to our little ship sitting there, and it was like a phone from God. So we always say God was calling and someone got called. Yeah, you had to wait 3 days to get through to Christmas Island.
There must have been a fantastic feeling when you know finally do connect. And
Yeah, but three days.
Yeah, to sit at the post office for 3 days because we never had a phone at home. And the ladies felt sorry for you and used to bring out your tea and coffee while you were sleeping on the bench.
So what were your duties?
I was a underwater control UC. But otherwise, it was all pretty well seamanship work I did. When I originally joined, I joined up as a SBA, which is like a medic. That wasn't my cup of tea. I didn't enjoy it real much. And I enjoyed working in X-ray, but that was my best place to work, I thought.
So what was some of the kind of duties and responsibilities that, as a UC, you'd have to participate
in? Well, just ship's husbandry. I got collared with quartermaster a lot of the times, and you just had to more or less be at the gangway and take all the phone calls and see who goes on and off and check it out that way. But yeah, we had a good time on the Diamantina, didn't we?
How long would you be? Would you have been on each of these vessels so far?
At a time. The Swan, I was on there only for a short time. I can't even remember times now. On the Diamantina, we was on there nearly 2 years, weren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, after the Diamantina, we got posted up to HMAS Coonawarra. That's a land base up in Darwin. And this was just after the cyclone. I got posted up there about a week after the cyclone. I got flown in early. And our first job up there was, looking at the Navy's had a lot of properties scattered around Darwin, and me and a couple other blokes, our job was to stop looters from coming into the Navy houses. That was a really good job, that one. I suppose we were the worst looters, I suppose.
That was Cyclone Tracy?
Yeah. We'd go around and get all the grog and sit back and drink it all. The accommodation we had up in Darwin was pretty bad. We were living in caravans for a while, living in half houses for a while, sharing houses. But I really enjoyed my time up in Darwin. It was real laid back. And then we got a posting to the Daring Class destroyers, HMAS Vendetta. I was only on that posting probably about 6 months because they were looking at paying it off. And for some reason, I got posted onto HMAS Vampire. But during this time, I'd already put in to volunteer for submarines. And back in them days, you had to volunteer to be in submarines, and you had to at least be in 4 years before you could put your name down for it.
And why was that?
Well, you had to have a bit of seniority in the Navy. and volunteer. You had to volunteer because it was because it's not a place people wanted to get posted on submarines. It was a volunteer position. Later on, it wasn't. People got posted, but they didn't last long. They ended up getting out. It's got to be something that you want to do. And I always wanted to be in submarines. Finally got in submarines in 1977, and we got sent to the UK for training. That was a good time we had there, a lot of fun. Our instructor, he was a pretty good bloke, Mike Jones, and he was a chief stoker. And we had a lot of fun. He used to take us away when we were there and show us all the different castles, because I used to love looking at castles. Couldn't get enough castles. Even when me and Jackie went back there a few times, all I wanted to do was look at castles. And we had a pub just across the bridge where we always used to... We adopted that pub as our pub while we was there. And because the landlady, she really looked after us and put spreads on for us, food and all this. And all we had to do was drink a beer. And when I was on, then I got posted to submarines, and that's when we was in New Zealand on HMAS Otway. And my son was born. I got a signal in the middle of the night. We were sleeping and, "Oh, Jeff, you got a son." And I said, "Oh, beauty," and went back to sleep. And in the morning, I woke up and I thought, I wonder if that was true or I was dreaming. And I went down to the signals office and they said, yeah, and they gave me the signal. So he was there to see me when I got back, with my mum and dad there waiting. That was good.
After the day that your son was born, how much longer was it before you were able to return to actually see him for the first time?
Oh, it was probably about a month after he was born that we got back to see him that first time.
How did you feel? Do you remember the feelings, emotions?
Well, not really. I'm not a sort of emotional guy that sort of way. It's just good to see him, yeah. What did you say? I reckon I was like Jackie when I saw Lance first time.
When you saw?
Lance.
Oh, I had the moon.
Yeah.
You were that excited because he was 10 days old when you first saw him, and Mum was there too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, there you go, 10 days, not a month.
pretty early in the day.
He was very emotional.
Yeah. Then when we was on the Onslow, we got the movie Attack Force Z, and who was starring in that?
Mel Gibson
and... Oh, God, I can't think of the names now. A few good Aussie names. And what happens there is the submarine, when the movie first starts, the submarine surfaces, and our XO comes running down and knocks on the torpedo loading hatch. And the hatch opens and one guy runs out, and I was the second guy running out. And my mum saw the movie, and of course it was on the big screen, and she always said, "That's my son." And my dad said, "You should have been looking mean because it's at war, not coming out smiling." Yeah.
So you've seen that a few times?
Yeah, I've got a copy of the movie, yeah. Attack Force said. It's a pretty good movie. It's still a pretty good movie. Then we was off Onslow there, and we was off New Zealand. And this big mega storm was there. Mum and Dad were on a cruise ship that time, and we even made the local paper on the ship, because the storm was that bad. This is before sat-nav and all that, and we had to take fixes to find out where we are from the stars or the sun. And because the storm was so big, for days we couldn't take a fix, so we was only going by dead reckoning. That's where you think you should be by your speed. Doesn't take in the currents or the storms. And we was about 300 miles off course, and we went to dive deep. And as we were diving, I remember just stood up, and there was a lot of whales around. There was a stack of whales around us. And as we went deep, went bang, and put me straight back down on the seat. The next minute, bang, 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 we were hitting the bottom. And I thought we hit a whale because there were so many around us. But it wasn't. We ended up hitting the bottom because we were 300 miles off course and there was a seamount there. And we had to surface, go back in, and we had to go straight back to Sydney to get the boat checked over, make sure there's no cracks or any damage done to it.
It's fairly hard impact.
Oh, yeah, because you're only doing about 5 or 6 knots underwater, but it's, that's still pretty fast to hit something. Another time, remember, we was down deep, and we had a flood. And that's one of the worst things you can have on a submarine is a flood, because the sea pressure, once you're down deep, or when you go down to, say, 600 feet, you can put a string across the two bulkheads of the submarine. By the time you get to 600 feet, that string's hanging on the deck because the submarine gets squashed in with the pressure. And if you have a flood, even just a small pinprick of a flood, that water comes out like a bullet and it'll kill you dead. And they had this. We had a flood from the shaft, one of the shafts, and we did an emergency surface. This is the only one I've ever been in, or it's the only one I've ever known the submarines to do. And we blew all the tanks and blew water out of the tanks that keep us down there, put air in to make us buoyancy, and did a full rise on the planes and full ahead to get us out of the water before we came too heavy. Because the longer you're there, the heavier you get, the more you start going backwards. And then you're finished. And we come out the water. You remember the TV show, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, where the submarine comes shooting out? And that's how we came out. We come out clear. And I was up the forward mess when it happened. And of course, it was like no gravity. You just floated in the air, and we thought, this is good. Good bit of a buzz, and we come down heavy, bang, hit the sea. And then because we come up so quick, the fin and all the casing is still full of water. So that made us top heavy, and we started to roll. And we were leaning and leaning. We thought, oh, there's an extra bonus thrown in here. And then when we started standing on our bunks, we realised that something bad was going to happen. And we was in a couple of degrees of tipping over. And if the submarines tip over, you got all the batteries that are not bolted down or nothing. The engines aren't bolted down. They're just sitting on clogs. And everything would have fell off. And we got 2 batteries on the submarine. And oh, wow, I think it's 224 cells in there, and each cell weighs 0.5 ton. And that would have just come through the floor, because there's only just thin, very thin decking on there. That was a sort of a good experience.
Wow,
I didn't even have that one written down. I'd forgotten that one. Another time we had a fire in the forward mess, and I was sleeping the reverse way round in me bunk. So we must have been on the surface. I think we're about a day out of New Guinea or something. And it was very rough. So I slept the reverse way round so I wouldn't fall out of me bunk. And you have a little curtain. That's your only privacy. You got a small curtain that pulled across. And I heard the night alarm go off, and it was emergency forward mess, fire, fire, fire. I went, oh shit, that's where I am. So I pulled the curtain back with my foot. And as I did that, this flame went whoosh into my bunk. And I went, holy shit, the fire's where I was. And so I'm trying to push the curtain back with my foot. And this flame's coming through. And I went, oh Jesus, and I'm pushing it back. And next minute, all the smoke come in. So I put my head in my sleeping bag, but that didn't work no good. So I had to make the choice. Either I die from smoke or I run through the fire and get burnt. So I thought I'd better run through the fire. There's more chance of surviving. So I quickly ripped my curtain back and hoping I could get out fast enough without getting burnt too much. And next minute I felt this water hit me. And I went, thank Christ for that. So they got there and they put the fire out. It was electrical fire, but they put it out and the kettle was on fire actually. But it was a big flame. It was, yeah. You had to sit there quickly thinking, what am I going to do? Suffocate or get badly burnt? I got burnt once before on the, we was on the surface, running on the surface, and it was pretty rough. And I was waiting to go and watch. And on submarines, all you wore was a pair of footy shorts and a T-shirt. That's what you lived in. You lived in the same clothes that you wore and slept in. You never sort of took them off. And you go out for 3 months and that's what you wear for 3 months. And depending where you were, if you're in the tropics, the submarine's hot inside. If you're in the cold, well, the submarine's freezing inside. There's no air conditioning. There's only forced air that goes through. And I remember we was in shorts and a T-shirt, and I was laying on my stomach, just on my bunk there. And next thing, I felt something hot against my leg, and I thought, oh, someone's left a cup on the next to my bunk, and because there's a little shelf there, and it's bloody rolled under my bunk. So I did a little press up to try and get the cup out. Then I realised that wasn't the cup, it was the kettle, and it was still steaming away. And so I'm yelling out for help because I couldn't push myself up any higher and I couldn't grab the kettle because it was red hot sort of thing because it's cooking away. So I'm yelling out for help and one of the four Indies come through and ripped the kettle away from me there. And I was sitting there with all these burns on my legs. I first went down to the wash place area and ran the hose on my legs to try and get rid of the burns. And the coxswain come up and he said, go sit up the mess, Jeff, I'll give you something for the pain. I said, beauty. And so I sat up there and he forgot to come up because he was looking up what to do about burns. Ended up I had huge big joint blisters on me, but I still had to go back on watch because we were still at sea, so all I wore was a pair of jocks. And passageways only about these wide, so if I was walking up the passageway, everybody had to get out of my way. And I had to walk sideways so my blisters didn't touch nothing. And you still went on watch, you still worked. You couldn't have time off because if you had time off, someone had to do your job for you. So you got to pull your weight. Remember when we were going to burst the blisters and the coxswain took me into the fore ends and I'm laying on a torpedo there and all the lads are sitting around to watch it and they're sitting above me and all this and we're all sitting there watching the coxswain burst the blisters, and the first one he burst, there must have been a hell of a pressure beyond because it all went straight up and hit the blokes in the faces and they were going, oh, at the end there was no one there to watch the rest of them. And another time we was on the ovens, we did a dive dentry into Jervis Bay, and when we surfaced, they didn't shut 6 and 7 main vents at the back of the submarine. And so that started filling up with water again. And luckily the engine room picked up the angle was not correct. And they shut their hatch straight away. And because the hatches weigh a ton and they're big round thick doors like this, and they shut their hatch. But otherwise they couldn't have shut it. They couldn't have pushed it up. And he shut it just in time. And by this time, the water started coming in through the hatch. When we surfaced, the lookout and the officer run up the top. And we got two hatches which they go through. And the water started coming in through the hatch. And we first didn't realise what was going on because no one's ever seen it before. And water started coming in. Next minute, it was coming faster. By this time, the boat was coming underwater. And so the deeper it got, the more water that come in. And it was just a big bore of water. And you've got a rope which goes to the top hatch. And it's there for that purpose of if you ever have to pull it shut, if this ever happened. Of course, it's never happened and no one's ever really tried it. And, of course, we were going backwards and Everyone was underneath this rope trying to pull the hatch shut. But the deeper you went, the more pressure that pushes the hatch back up. And the noise was tremendous. The captain was on the after periscope. You could see him giving orders, but no one could hear what he's saying anyway. And everyone was just panicking about getting this hatch shut. And eventually it came down, bang. And I remember me, a young sonar operator there, and I was the UC1, and the senior sonar man, he goes, "Uckers, that's UC1. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can I stand up?" And I looked at him, and water's sitting here on him. I said, "Yeah, stand up, son, you'll be right." We ended up, we was too heavy to remain on the surface. We sank to the bottom, so luckily we was in harbour, it was 300 foot of water in Jervis Bay, so lucky it was shallow enough for us to, without going straight down, because we wouldn't have come up, we were too heavy. And we had to remain there until they pumped us all out full of water. We couldn't go nowhere, we just had to remain in the control room, because they ended up shutting the other hatch, and so it was just the control room that got flooded up. And we've just been out of a major refit where we had all the new electronic gear and everything in the control room. And that all got stuffed. And yeah, we had a surfers and we sneaked in at night time, and poor captain lost his command over that. He was gone within a week.
How terrifying.
And that was his first command too.
How terrifying was that?
Well, you didn't have time to worry about terrifying. It's when it all stopped that you thought, "Oh God," because you remember in your training about the air, CO2 getting compressed from water rising, and we had to break out the mask. We got masks there that we clip in and we can all breathe. But that was a worry. Thought, "Oh shit, what if the CO2 gets higher?" We end up getting pumped out and we surfaced and sort of. Oh yeah, I got another one. We was down deep, and we was coming up to periscope depth. We were going to recharge the batteries. And what happens is we do a slow sonar search first to make sure there's no contacts. And then the submarine starts coming up. As it's coming up, we go through quickly with the sonar, just making sure nothing's around us while we're coming up. And then once we come to the periscope depth, the captain does a real quick look around with the periscope, and then he does a slow look around. And we also do slow sonar searches to make sure nothing's around us. So we did all that, nothing around us. And so we opened up and started the generators on. And as soon as we started them up, we heard a noise. And the only thing that makes that is another submarine. And what it does is the cavitation from the propellers off the submarine going fast. And as soon as we heard it, we could hear it through the pressure hole. It was that close. And I hit record, and we recorded it. And what it was a Soviet November-class nuclear submarine. And this is all happening during the Cold War, of course. And I remember we used to get the Chinese and things like that. We used to find them. The Oberon classes were a really good submarine, very quiet. And remember, we used to sneak up on the. We had this Chinese. We couldn't work out what it was first, and then we recorded it was a Chinese, and we were following it. We followed it for about a couple of hours, and we needed to recharge our battery. So the only thing we could do was transmit on it. Let him know that we was there and we knew he was there, sort of thing. And next, off he went. Well, they happened around Australia's waters, so they shouldn't have been there. We used to get all sorts of submarines. Remember one we had there? It was we never heard it before, and we got the first recording of it. We called it Bioduck, because bio is biological and duck because it sounded. Quack, 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 quack. We knew it was man-made and mechanical because the sound and your gut feeling what it was. And we were recording this a lot, and so were a couple of other submarines. And We were sending it in to get analysed to find out what they could think it was, and come back with all these stupid things that we knew it wasn't, but they'd come back with stupid ideas. And I remember we had this American chief. He was a sonarman, and we had him over. He was doing something, but he come down our mess, and we were all drinking there. And I asked him about, has these boats ever heard of Bioduck? And he said, no, I've never heard that name. I said, well, it's probably just a local name that we call it. He said, have you got any recordings of it? I said, yeah, come with me. So I took him up to submarine school, and we played the noise to him. As soon as he heard it, he goes, oh! The shock and horror on his face, and he goes, God damn, I didn't think anybody had that noise. And I said, you know what it is? And he goes, yeah. I said, what is it? He goes, I can't tell you, but I can tell you it's friendly. So it's obviously a Yank submarine. And it's probably one of their big boomers or something. And it scared the hell out of him that we had these recordings. And so, you know, like he said, unclassified. I can't tell you what it is, but I can tell you it's friendly.
Did you ever find out what it was?
No, not in my time. But, well, I knew then it was American anyway. But American what? I don't know. But for the shock horror on his face, I would say it's probably one of their big boomers, one of their big nuclear carriers. I was up the submarine school, and I was the instructor up there. I had to teach advanced sonar courses and officers, sonar for officers, and part, you know, young trainees. I'd give them all the basic sensors, talk, and, you know, and did that job for about a year.
So in total, how many years were you actually out on the sea?
Oh, on sea, geez, where's a lot?
A lot.
Yeah, I was more times at sea than I was at home there. We moved around a lot too, didn't we? We had, how many moves we have?
Our last one here was about 38.
38 moves.
38 moves.
How do you adapt or adjust?
Just do. I think it, because I was so used to it. Right from day one, you went to sea and we moved a couple of places over there, and it, you just got used to it.
Well, our first year of marriage, I only saw you about 100 days, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, it was less than 100.
Was it?
Yeah. So.
That must have been pretty tough for you.
It was, but it was good. I mean, you've got to adjust to it, or it'd break you. There were so many breakups, so many affairs going on. But, you know, it was a toughened job. It was hard on the kids, because the kids didn't have lifelong friends because everybody moved around so much. Our son said, a couple of years ago, wasn't it? I've never had the lifelong friends that other people have because of the services. But only he enjoyed it just as much as we did, because you're moving all the time and things like that. So it had its good times and it had its bad times. We just adapted, didn't we, Jim?
Yeah, yeah. We've always done things together, yeah, haven't we? Even worked together a lot. You've been me boss a few times and jobs. And
can you just list off some of the places you've lived out of those 38 moves?
Seven Hills. Sydney, we had 1, 2, 3, 4 moves in Sydney. Then we went up to Darwin, didn't we? Yeah. Oh, hang on. Now, when we first started, we were in Melbourne. We had 3 moves in Melbourne. Then we went up to Perth. We had 2 moves there. Then we went up to Darwin. We had 2, 3 moves there. Back down to Sydney and we had 4 moves there. Queensland, we had 2 moves.
2 moves in Victoria.
2 moves in Victoria.
Back down to Victoria and we had 2 moves there.
Then we left from there. We went to came to Adelaide, and a lot of moves around. The rest of the moves around here to all the Selix Beach to Morgan to Tail and Bend to Wanaka, Wanaka to Paringa, oh, it goes on and on. And then we finally settled here. I said, well, maybe this is our last move because our son's down here and our granddaughter's born, and so we moved down here to be with her. Been good.
Yeah, and me. After I left submarines, I had a mate who was in postings, George McKenzie, and And he said, he knew I was getting out shortly, and he said, "Oh, where would you like to go? I'll give you one." I said, "Oh, what do you got up Queensland? I haven't lived up there before." And he goes, "What about up Cairns?" And I said, "Yeah, that'll do me." So he gave me a posting on the HMS Flinders. It was a survey vessel, very small boat, only had a crew of about 30 people. And my job up there was the buffer. I was in charge of all seamanship evolutions, all wire work, and of course it's all new to me. I'd never seen it before. And so what was happening on that day, I had to go away that night and learn up real quick and then watch it being put together, then, you know, take charge of it sort of thing. But Flinders was good. We had a good time up there. The captain and me got on really well. We're about the same age, and we used to compete against each other in anything we did. And I stopped that after once we was at anchor up and off New Guinea, some island off New Guinea, and captain, I was diving off the side of the ship, and the captain went one eye, and he said, "Buffer, look at me." So I said, "No, don't be an idiot, you know." And of course he dives off, and you heard there's a mighty crack. And I raced over to him. I said, "You're right." And he goes, "Yeah." He said, "I won't do that again." I said, "Let's cut this stupid, you know, business out." He goes, "All right then." That was a good ship. They had a lot of fun on there.
How much time did you spend on HMAS Flinders?
At Flinders, spent about 18 months.
18 months, yeah. Yeah. And I more or less threw the claw in then. I thought, because once the captain left, it wasn't the same. And you started getting a couple of more crew on, and it wasn't my liking anymore. So I got a posting to Cerberus. And that was my discharge posting then. I worked, my last job in the Navy, I worked up at Comtrain. And what it was we were making courses, like a cook's course, all combined, Air Force, Army and Navy, was all going to come to one school and learn it. And we was making up courses for that, and the military polices and things like this. And we got on well there too, didn't we? It was sort of... I got away with a whole lot of crap up there, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, 91 I went to Cerberus. And 92 I got out, August 92. So I did 22 years in. I retired as a chief petty officer. Proud of my service I had. Proud of my submarine time. Also, being a submariner as elite, one of the elite naval forces, and not many people got to be a submariner. Now, after I left the Navy, my brother-in-law, and he said, "Why don't you leave the Navy?" And I thought about it. Yeah, otherwise I'd be an old dinosaur, one of them blokes that didn't happen this way, son, in my time, you know. And I thought, yeah, time to get out. You know, it must be something else besides the Navy. And I didn't really have an idea what I was going to do. But before I joined the Navy, I was either going to be a sailor or a policeman. I met a bloke through the Marion RSL I was a member of, and he was a friend of my dad's. He owned a security company, and he said, "Would I like to try security?" And I said, "Yeah, all right then." So got me licence, and I had a job at the Meyer Centre. And he lost the contract not long after that, and new people come in. But I ended up working there for 4 years, and oh, did we have a lot of fun there. You know, we doing things now that you couldn't get away with now, you know, we used to do. But it was a lot of fun, and we did that for 4 years. And then the people who owned, who had the contract there then, it was Festival State Securities, they were moving to Sydney. And they were going to start up new there. And me and Jackie got asked if we want to come and help them start up the new company. And so we thought about it for about 2 seconds, and we said, yeah, we'll come. And so we moved over to Sydney, and the company didn't go that good because they went in partnership with these other two blokes, and they didn't like us. They didn't want us there. They weren't showing us anything. They were just making us do things wrong and then blame us. And so we gave them the flick that night. We said, oh, look, we're not working here anymore. And I then got a job with the New South Wales Department of Health as a armed special constable. That was a good one. We were based up in the brand new Children's Hospital there. We had a nice big office, and that was a good job. I did that for 4 years. Had some good mates there. And then I left there. We moved back. We made the decision to come back living back in South Australia. Jackie said she wanted to move back. So we come back here, and I originally got a little security job then. I put my name down for the prisons, and I got the position, and for 10 years I was a prison officer. I did a year at the ARC, the Remand Centre, and I did a year at Cadell, but that wasn't my cup of tea. It was too low security for me, and so I then moved over to Mobalong Prison and did 8 years there. That was that I didn't mind. That was more hands-on.
What was it about that form of work? What attracted you to that job?
Well, I suppose it's uniform still, eh?
Yeah.
But uniforms all my life, you know. And it was better than security. You're working for the government, so you had government backing behind you. And oh, me and Jackie, we got that picture there, that second one down there. Jackie and me, they had a big do at the prison, and they had the Minister for Corrections and everything there. And me and Jackie got a special award, a special prize, for being just good people, I suppose, and always helping out doing things. And like on that day, I said, look, well, we'll cook the barbecue, because no one else wanted to do nothing. And then I rounded up a couple of blokes to help me, and we got called out, and that was the boss of the jail there. And he gave us a special award for being good people. It all comes back from, you know, military training, and you was looked upon better too because you had military training and that. And a lot of the prisoners used to treat you different. I remember a couple of black fellas, they were causing a bit of strife, and I went to smooth it down, and they turned around and said I was racist to them. And the ALO, which is the Aboriginal guy who, you know, job to look after them, he come over and said, don't you ever call Mr. Harding racist. He's the most unracist man I've ever known, you know. And of course these two lads sucked back, and from there on they never harassed me again that way. Then I got my TPI, which is totally permanently incapacitated, and I've been on that since 2010. So that was my last job, the prisons. I love being retired, yeah. Best thing is you get up when you want to get up, and there's no rush unless we're doing something. We've always got something to do. We're always busy, aren't we? We've got our granddaughter. We have her, you know, every day after school. We take her to Taekwondo twice a week. And we're always busy. Always got something to do. Always, you know, find something in the shed I can do. And I'm not a big watcher of TV. I like to be doing something all the time. But, yeah, we slip straight into it. We used to self-medicate. We drank a lot. Like we'd come back in at, say, 3 o'clock in the morning, and we'd open the bar. So we'd all go across and drink in the bar, and Jackie had to wait till we were all finished drinking. But you was always accepted and being part of it. And we'd let a lot of dues at the Platypus, is where the submarines used to tie up. And they had a great bar there. And we used to get all the coppers and the nurses from North Sydney, and that used to always come down and drink there. We used to have a lot of dues. Remember that one up in Cairns on New Year's Eve when Mum and Dad come up and visit us, And we was at a loose end, what can we do New Year's Eve? And I said, oh, we'll just go down to the mess and have a few drinks down there. And they got a good setup there. They had just outside the mess, you had the swimming pool. And we had these two Tongan little warships in, and they were at loose ends too. So we got them to come down to the mess. And first of all, we had carols by candlelight you organised and got everyone doing. And it was funny, we started sitting outside first having the carols and the sing-along, but the mozzies come out and, God, they were like monsters, and they'd go through your clothing, and people started going, you know, little taps here, there, and at the end everyone's slapping themselves. So we moved it inside the mess, and we had quite a crowd, but the mess was pretty full. And the Tongans, they put some drinks on, they bought lollies for all the kids that was there. Oh, they had a great time. And then New Year's Eve, they were still there, and we invited them down for a few drinks down the mess. And what a good night that was.
It was.
It was a hooly night. People were getting chucked in the pool. No one paid for a drink because the barman got too pissed to take money, so... Everybody's drinking everything, and Mum got chucked in, and she said she was going to tell these Tongans' mother that you chucked a grandmother in the pool, and he goes, oh, don't tell my mother, don't tell my mother, and New Year's Eve 91, that was.
You two first met in
74 or something, I think.
Got married in 74.
Did we? Must have been 73 then.
Met you, 73, beginning of 73.
So the last 10 years since Jeff's retired.
It's been busy.
We cruised a lot.
Yeah, we go on holidays. When we were up at Murray Bridge, we were involved with the RSL up there a lot. And
You were the bar manager.
I was bar manager for that.
And we had a lot of fun there.
Then we went up to Pringa, then back to Wanaka, and then down here. So, it's been good. We do, as Jeff said, we do a lot of cruises. We have a lot of things with our granddaughter and son.
Working for the Department of Health, I also had a security licence, so we could, nice to work security with the races. And Jackie used to be in charge of the races, the security in the races.
This is back in New South Wales?
Yeah,
this is when I was working for the Department of Health there. Jackie, she was a store detective, and you got to be a bit of a living legend there too, didn't you? And store detective in Sydney and also here. Yeah, you was hunted and people wanted you.
Yeah.
We've been offering you more money all the time. Come work for us, and we'll give you a lot more money.
It was good. I enjoyed that job.
Yeah, you was good at it. Still got it.
Yeah.
You still pick up shoppies. When you go out, she goes, that bloke's going to steal that. And I reckon, which bloke? She goes, look at that bloke there. He's going to steal that. And of course, in the pocket it goes. And while you was working there, I was Jackie's husband, wasn't I? Oh, you Jackie's husband. And instead of the always other way around, you were Jeff's wife.
It was good time security.
Yeah. My grandfather, Alban Ernest Harding, he served in the First World War. And he was overseas for 4 years. And he originally joined up as a driver. And that was because they had horses and buggies and everything then too. And halfway through the war, he changed over to a gunner. He worked on a medium trench mortars. And he was born with a veil over his head. And that's like a good luck thing. And the gypsy type people, they love the veil. They'll pay any amount of money for that. Especially really good luck. And the way some of the stories goes, you can see it. He's lunchtime there, they were by this farmhouse, and this plane came down and started machine gunning him. And of course, he went to run away, but he had nowhere to run. There was a wall there, so he just stood there. And the machine gun's fire went either side of his neck. He had little brown marks there where the bullets went, either burned his skin either side of his neck. Another story, there was a dead chook out in them sort of like no man's land, and they all egged my grandfather on to go out and get him. And so he went out and he crawled across there, and a sniper had a go at him and burnt underneath his nose. And he had that little sort of hole underneath his nose where the bullet went through. And another, on his way back, a bullet went across, right across his eyes. But he came back with the chook and he was the hero of the day. Another time, he was the one dropping the shells into the mortar. And he reckons, he just, something come over and he said, I want to change. He said, I want to be a getter, you know, where you'd go across, grab the ammo from the dump and bring it back for the next bloke who'd drop it in. And so he swapped around with his mate. And as he went to grab the next shell, his mate dropped one in, and it was a faulty shell and blew up the whole gun crew. He was the only one who survived it. He got gassed during the war. He got trench feet. He had trench feet. They even afterwards you could show you his feet and they were sort of all deformed type thing. He served all over. He never went to Gallipoli, but from there on he was all on the Western Front. He went to went to all the major battles there. It's my dad's name, Lance too. His name's Lance Alvin Harding. He served on the Quadrant. HMS Quadrant during the end of the war. He was with the occupational forces up in Japan.
Did he share many stories with you?
Yeah, Dad used to tell a few. And that's one reason why I joined the Navy, I think, too, because of the stories Dad used to tell me at night, you know, I'd lay in bed. And I'd always say, tell me a war story, Dad. Because he never actually served in the war part because he joined too late. Boss wrote a letter and got him out of service because he was doing his butcher apprentice. And Dad joined up and went to medical, and his boss found out and he wrote a letter saying, you know, he wanted him to finish. And so Dad finished and then he joined the Navy. But it was the last year of the war and it was pretty well over by the time he actually got to sea. But he was up Japan for the occupational forces there. And one story he told me, he was hitching a ride to go visit a friend who was on another ship. And he was on short leave and this big American truck pulled up and this huge black man in there, he reckons. And he said, get in, Oz. And on the way down to where they were going, he reckons, God, he was like a madman. If he saw some white Americans, he'd drive the truck straight towards them, make them jump out the road. And of course, he'd laugh and laugh and laugh. I remember my dad once telling me there was an English ship, they were tied up next to that anchor also. And they went across in a boat and they did a commando raid. And I think they took the crown that was on one of the poles, and they was going to keep it for a souvenir. And of course the Poms got real shirty over that, and so me dad had to return it, and he got under punishment for that. But that didn't last long because a big cyclone came in Japan and they had to go to sea, get out of the way of it.
Over the last period of your life, how much has the RSL really been a factor of
it's been a big factor with me. I join all the different RSLs I go to. Wherever we've moved to, I've become part of the RSL, and I sort of put myself right in there, either by being on the committee or doing everything. Barbecues, I'm usually Santa. We have a Christmas set up. I put myself right into it, and Jackie also plays a big part in it. Like we said, Murray Bridge, she was the bar manager there, and we was pretty well at the club nearly every day, yeah, weren't we? And that was good there. And oh, we used to have some really good hoolies there. Some nights, you know, just impromptu, one of the coppers used to play the piano really good. And I'd all come knock off work, come across, and we'd have big sing-alongs. And sometimes we didn't shut till about 2 a.m, and things like this. And oh, we used to have some roaring good shows there. Too, I was the president of the Renmark RSL for a while. Yeah, the Naval Association up there. Tail and Bend, I was part of the Tail and Bend RSL. Marion RSL.
Sydney RSL,
yeah, and one up in where we lived up Cadell there. Where we
Morgan
lived.
RSL.
Yeah, Morgan RSL. I find that a lot of the services are a lot different now from when we was in, whereas we had big messes in the Navy, and so, yeah, got to be where everyone lived together in messes. Now they're having like 6-man cabins and things like that. You'd only know your small group of 6 people roughly, and then knowing about 30 people all living together. But when you look at it now, yeah, I was one of the youngest blokes, and you still think you're the youngest blokes, but you're getting up there in age. It's hard to get young members in because they don't want to come in because it's ran by old blokes who are set in their ways and do things this way. And I say to them, well, it always will be until you get young blokes in to change it. I said, we're all adaptable. We'll change. We'll go with the flow of what comes in. But you got to come in and do it. But until then, I say, oh, it's full of old people, you know. But for your question, the RSL has always been a part of my life. I like it. I like having the... I like talking to military men, you know. We all sort of think along the same lines. Usually what I find, blokes, when they get around their 40s and 50s, they miss the comradeship they had back in their military days. And that's usually when you get them to join RSLs, when they're around in their 40s to 50s. It's you don't get them much younger, really. And look at it, when the Vietnam vets took over, they always swore that they'd never be part of the RSL, but eventually they're now running the RSL. And it'll be the same with the Afghan blokes, I suppose they'll say the same thing, but eventually they will come of age where they might miss the military. And they think about back when days and how they enjoyed themselves in the military. And then they'll probably take over and the place will be covered in Afghan stuff and the Vietnam War will be down the end of the hall or something like that.
Jeff and Jackie Harding, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. You're a wonderful couple. You're just such lovely people. Thank you so much for sharing these stories with me today. It's been my privilege. Thank you.
Are we finished? I was going to start spinning some stories. I haven't told any yet.
You'll be here all night.
We'll just talk about you when you're gone.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.